In this video, we're going to talk about the initiation of physical force as evil from Chapter 8 of Leonard Peikoff's book, Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. Stay tuned. All right, so let's start out with a summary of this section. So we get that the initiation of physical force is not, for objectivism, the only evil, but it is a special form of evil. And it's a special form of evil. It's a unique form of evil because it's the only form of evil that can stop us from engaging in a self-interested course of action. It's the only thing that can stop us from using our minds to understand the world and pursue the good. That every other form of evil leaves the victims free to continue the process of thinking required to live. And so force, by contrast, negates and paralyzes the mind. And we get an analysis of both of those issues. So for paralysis, force paralyzes the mind when you're ordered to embrace an idea. And the result is paralysis because it, in effect, gives you contradictory orders. It says, on the one hand, well, you're supposed to think, right? You're supposed to perform a process, but it's a process that can not have a preset outcome. It's follow the evidence wherever it may lead. That is what it means to think. And on the other hand, they're dictating the outcome. It's follow the evidence wherever it may lead, but it damn well better lead to where I say it will. And so that's impossible. It's a contradiction. There's nothing you can do cognitively in the face of those kind of orders. You can't think in compliance with force. And so in that sense, your mind is paralyzed. And we'll talk more about what that means when we get to a later part of this discussion. But then force negates your mind when it's directed not at your beliefs, not at your ideas, but at your actions. And it says, do what I say regardless of what you think. So it's not saying that, like, I'm going to convince you that me having your wallet is better than you having it. It's, I don't care what you think, just give me the wallet. Your mind is irrelevant, and it's the coercer's will that's all that counts. And Leonard puts it this way: physical force, to the extent it is wielded or threatened, denies to its victim the power to act in accordance with his judgment. Such treatment is tantamount, in Ayn Rand's words, to forcing a man to act against his own sight, and it places the individual in an impossible metaphysical position. If he does not act on the conclusions of his mind, he is doomed by reality. If he does, he is doomed by the forcer. And because force is anti-mind, it's also the antithesis of every other rational virtue and value. And we get a few examples of this, the way in which both the victim and the coercer are at odds with virtue when the coercer engages in the initiation of physical force. And so, for example, you nullify a person's, your victim's independence if you're a coercer, and in the process, you're becoming a second-hander who's dependent on them. You're dependent on your victim. And so we get that nothing good can come from force, not for the forcer, not for his victims, not even if he, quote, sincerely believes that, or sincerely tries to force the good on people. So it's just as we've talked about, you can't detach the good from a cognitive process. You can't detach values. You can't detach truth from a cognitive process. You can't detach values from an evaluative process. And force, as we've seen, is, it's making that impossible. To say that it negates and paralyzes the mind is to say that it stops you from thinking and from valuing. And so the way that Ayn Rand puts it, an attempt to achieve the good by physical force is a monstrous contradiction, which negates morality at its root by destroying a man's capacity to recognize the good, i.e. his capacity to value. An attempt to achieve the good by force is like an attempt to provide a man with the picture gallery at the price of cutting out his eyes. Values cannot exist, cannot be valued, outside the full context of a man's life, needs, goals, and knowledge. And then we get some clarifications of what is meant by the initiation of physical force is evil. So first of all, it is physical. That if we're talking about social pressure or disappointment that other people cause you or something like that, those don't attack your body or negate your mind, and therefore they're unable to bring your life-sustaining thinking process to a halt. So the way that Leonard puts it is, the only kind of social pressure that cannot be resisted by intellectual means is the kind that does not rely on intellectual means. We get that it's not synonymous with violence. So if you think about somebody like Tony Soprano, yeah, sometimes he's smashing people over the head, but sometimes it's just walking into a business in his area and saying, oh, nice business. It'd be sad if something happened to it. Hey, by the way, why don't you cut me a check? But it's not violence. It's the initiation of physical force, which can be subtle and it can be indirect. So that's the next point, is that the initiation of physical force is not limited to direct force, but it includes indirect forms, of which there are a number. But if you would take the simplest case of fraud, when you have a fraud, the transaction you consented to is not the one that actually took place. The interaction that took place is one you didn't consent to. And therefore, in that sense, that is force. It's doing something without your consent, even though it gets a phony consent to a phony transaction. And finally, it's that retaliatory use of force against the people initiated is moral. It's the only way. When somebody's said that, no, I'm not going to settle my disputes through persuasion, I'm not going to deal with others by reason, I'm going to act in effect like an animal, kill or be killed, well, they've left you with no alternative. In order to preserve yourself and protect yourself, you have to use force. And it's, you're using force not to gain any value from them, but basically to say, how can I go on with my life as if this person never existed? And it's only through physical means that you can stop someone who refuses to operate by rational means. Finally, we get to stress on this point that the evil of force is a conclusion. It's not a self-evident primary. And so altruism, for example, mandates the initiation of force. It's that you owe others, and therefore it's morally right for you to give them, for you to be forced to give them what you owe them. But more deeply, it's any form of unreason, in particular, if you think of the intrinsicism and subjectivism that leads to brutality. Because if we can't settle our disagreements by appealing to reason, then there's no other way to settle them except by resorting to guns. And it's precisely intrinsicism and subjectivism that say, well, no, reason does not lead to the true, reason does not lead to the good. And so it's, if you want to establish the evil of the initiation of force, it can only be by means of more fundamental ideas, in particular, the supremacy of reason and the moral nature of self-interest, of selfishness, of egoism. All right, so let's move on to analysis. And I want to underline this point that we mentioned at the outset, but that I think is really worth highlighting, which is that, because one objection that objectivism gets is, why are you so focused on force? You have this kind of force fetish where, like, oh, you think that's the worst thing in the world. And then they'll point out there's plenty of worse things in the world. Like, yeah, I mean, it's crappy when a bully punches you in the arm, but it's way worse if somebody lies to you, a lover betrays your trust. Or even you might think of something like, you have an obnoxious boss who's demanding really unfair things, stealing credit for work that you did. Like, these kinds of things, you're saying, well, those are free, voluntary, and you're obsessing about physical force. And this kind of objection will acknowledge, yeah, sometimes force can be bad, but lots of things can be bad. And the claim is not that force is always the worst thing that can happen to you. It's totally right that there are things that people can do that don't involve force, that shouldn't be, on the objectivist view, illegal, but are way worse. Think of Ayn Rand's evaluation of Kant. Like, he never killed anybody, although I think Leonard Peikoff once quipped, except for grad students reading the Critique. but she called him the most evil man in history. And it was because his ideas carried out into practice led to mass destruction, and in part by unleashing force, but in part just destruction of the individuals who were morally undercut by the ideas that he was preaching. And so but he was still dealing with people by persuasion, not coercion. And so the point is that force is a special form of evil, because it's special in that it's the only form of evil that can stop you from acting morally, that can stop you from pursuing your self-interest. It's one way to think about it is that what force does is it, and the way that it's experienced, is it's a loss of control over your life. And it's the only way that other people can put you in that state. And you can think about it as, what does it mean to be out of control? You can put yourself in an out of control state if you're not focusing your mind, if you're drifting or evading. To that extent, you're out of control. And so what force basically says is you in effect get, you become a whim worshiper against your will. But it's not your whims that you're worshiping. It's the person who's pointing the gun at your face and saying, act this way. And that, and the point is, it, precisely because objectivism says the root of all evil is evasion, force is a unique form of evil because it's the only one that can, in effect, make you act as if you were evading. And absent the initiation of force, no matter what bad thing is happening to you, you retain the ability to think and therefore to govern yourself through life towards knowledge and towards values. So let's talk a little bit about this claim that force negates and paralyzes the mind. We've said some things in our summary, but there's a couple clarifications that I think will be helpful here. So the first we can say is that, well, force can't make a person think. So it's, you know, you're not going to get like more scientific discoveries by ordering people to discover the new. Force then, it negates a person's thinking. How? It's by stopping him from acting on his own judgment. So it's like you pass your judgment, but that doesn't lead to anything in reality. And if you remember our whole discussion of reason as man's basic means of survival, the whole perspective there was that reason and its value as a faculty for human beings is precisely in order to guide action. And so the idea of like, well, you could leave reason intact, but just cut it off from its ability to govern your action in the world, that flies in the face of the whole objectivist perspective that no, this is an action guiding faculty, and that to negate it is to stop a person from acting on it is to basically render it useless, to render the mind, to render thinking useless. And to say then that it paralyzes the mind, this is the one I think gives people the most trouble. It's to say that force, it paralyzes the mind by detaching your mind from reality and preventing or stopping or disintegrating its contents. It's stopping the integration of your knowledge. And so if you think about how the mind works, as we've seen, it's by reason and by logic. And so if somebody's giving you an order that says there's something that supersedes reason and logic, there's something that supersedes following the evidence wherever it leads, then your mind can't do anything. It can't do anything cognitively, because remember, thinking is the processing of evidence. It's following steps of logic. It's looking out at the world and drawing conclusions by a certain process. It's not just simply, well, I have words running through my mind, or it's mouthing certain slogans. It's not however you feel. Like an intellectual conviction is not just, well, I feel that that's true. And so to say that force paralyzes your mind is not to say that your mind goes blank. There can be those kinds of things. There can be words running through your head, and you can be saying things or even feeling a kind of like, oh, I'm half convinced by this, but there's nothing cognitive that is going on at that point. It's not leading you to having any knowledge. And it's not that force is unique in terms of mental paralysis. Like, this is a more widespread phenomenon. To hold a contradiction is to experience mental paralysis. And maybe a good example of this is, if you read Ayn Rand, I think it's in her fiction, but maybe her nonfiction writing book, she talks about getting the squirms. And that's where, like, it's in effect writer's block. And her view is that what's often happening there is that your mind has a certain contradiction. So for example, it's like, well, I know this scene is necessary, or I think the scene is necessary. And the contradiction is that there's a subconscious contradiction where you go, no, this is completely unnecessary. And so I feel no desire, even horror, in sitting down to write it. And she thinks that what you have to do in order to move forward is to resolve the contradiction. And that's, you either convince yourself, yes, this really is rationally necessary in order for me to communicate my ideas, in which case she believes you'll feel motivation to write it. Or what you'll see is, oh, I thought this was necessary, but no, I actually don't need to go into this point. But that you're paralyzed by that contradiction until you resolve it. Or trying to think about the arbitrary. Remember, the arbitrary is that for which there is no evidence. And there's nothing you can do with that mentally. There's no cognitive action you can take. There's nothing to process precisely because there is no evidence. And so these are all examples of mental paralysis. And as the arbitrary illustrates, right? Like, people can mouth words with the arbitrary all day, and they certainly do. And some people like Alex Jones turn it into, you know, a multi-million dollar empire. But cognitively, in terms of the process that we described in the section on objectivity, there's no integration, there's no reduction, there's no conceptualization that you can engage in. And that's the sense in which force paralyzes the mind. It's basically trying to impose the arbitrary on somebody. And so in that sense, it's as fruitless as if you try to embrace the arbitrary yourself. I want to address a common confusion that comes up, and it'll often take this form, which is, well, look, I can see how it's bad to be the victim of force, but why is it bad for the perpetrator? And the basic answer we get from Leonard is that it involves the rejection of the virtues, that it's not just the victim, but the perpetrator who's rejecting the virtues. And remember, by this point, we've established the virtues are good, that these are the principles that lead to long-range success and happiness. And so the idea of, okay, well, isn't it to my interest to reject the virtues? Isn't that good for me? That's out. But now, I want to make a slightly deeper point. Now, this is something that we've covered in various ways in our discussion of why act on principle, of integrity, of honesty, and man's life as the standard. But it's worth circling back to from a slightly different perspective, and this is a more epistemological perspective, which is, so if we're starting with the assumption that we need to identify principles that lead to long-range success, then there's no such principle as, should I initiate force? Because if you said, well, yeah, I should, you'd recognize that immediately applies to every other human. It says, yeah, so should everybody else. And so what we're thinking about, what we're contrasting when we're thinking about force rightfully, is we're thinking about two alternatives. So one is an alternative where everybody uses force against everybody, or an alternative where, no, we deal with one another through persuasion voluntarily, justly. And if those are the two alternatives, it becomes pretty clear pretty quick that it's precisely dealing with others through persuasion, through reason, is to our interest, versus trying to, like, have a war against all, and, like, best case scenario is I come, you know, out on top of a bloody pile of human bodies, versus, you know, living in a free, peaceful society where, you know, we just get richer, healthier, and I benefit from other people's rationality. And you can, at that point, once you've gone through that kind of thinking process of, all right, those are the two alternatives in principle, which one is superior, which one is inferior, you can't say, okay, but what about in this one case, shouldn't I do it just if I can get away with it? And that goes back to a point that we've talked about, which is that what that really amounts to is, Why do I need principles? Can't I be inconsistent? Just live by the seat of my pants? And from objectivism's perspective, as we've talked about, the whole essence of evil is inconsistency. What evil says is not like, hey, shouldn't I initiate force every chance I get? It's, shouldn't I do it when I think I can get away with it? Evil is trying to get away with things. It is trying to escape the need for consistency. It is trying to evade the consequences of my actions. Like, hey, if I start, you know, using force against others, now they're going to start trying to use it against me. Turning to a different question, which is it really true that you can't force the good on someone? And let's give kind of the strongest, sort of example I think you could come up with for a case where it thinks, well, isn't that forcing the good on somebody? So I think it's really common that people have the experience of there's something that they want to do and they genuinely think, yeah, this would be good for me. Like, I need to eat less junk food. I need to save more for retirement. And I just like don't have enough self-control. And then you could imagine, you know, okay, government is going to like force us all to pay into Social Security and then cut checks to us decades later when we're old, paid by young people. Or they're going to ban, you know, trans fat filled treats or stop us from buying big gulps. And, you know, or like, man, I have a really addictive personality. And, you know, if CVS could just like sell, you know, ecstasy, ketamine and cocaine, I'd be done for. So isn't my life better because force is, you know, being used in that instance or in the instance of Social Security to kind of keep me on the straight and narrow? And I mean, there's a real phenomenon here, but notice who gains and who loses in that kind of analysis. Well, who gains, or at least who on the surface seems to gain, right, is the person who like either can't be bothered to think or who won't cultivate the self-discipline to act on their thinking, or who won't kind of figure out mechanisms by which to become, to make self-discipline more easy. And in some sense, yeah, that person wins. Like they're doing that, they have more incentives to do what they themselves have decided, we're assuming, is long-term in their interests. And they have more constraints preventing them from doing things that they think are bad for them. But what about the person who, let's take the issue of like saving for retirement. What about the person who says, you know what? Actually, saving for retirement is not my priority. I want to go all in on starting a business that I care about. I think I'll have more than enough money at some point, but setting that aside for an extra year or something because 12% of my income is going for the Social Security program, that's a bad deal for me. Or for the person who says, yeah, I mean, I want to save, but I want to put it in certain kinds of investments. And maybe 12% isn't right for me. Maybe it's less than that. Maybe it's more than that. The kind of person who engages in that thinking or who would engage in that thinking, they're being sacrificed. Their interests are being sacrificed in order for the person who's like, well, I can't be bothered to go through all that, or I can't trust myself to make those kinds of decisions. So what it basically means is we look at somebody like Kira from We the Living or Thomas Jefferson and say, you know what, you guys would be fine in a free society, but, you know, to use the example from the book Nudge, you know, the Homer Simpsons of the world, they're not going to be able to do what's good for them. So we're going to sacrifice the Kiras and the Thomas Jeffersons to the Homers, which is, from objectivism's perspective, morally perverse. And so that's the attempt to force the good on people amounts to sacrificing the rational to the irrational. And it's not that rational people never need kind of tools or strategies to keep themselves disciplined, but it's that they decide what are the right strategies and what are the right goals for which they need to be disciplined. So, you know, one of the things my friend and mentor Alex Epstein has talked about is, for example, having accountability partners. So it's really hard to stick to a diet, but it's not, I want the government to decide what the right diet is and impose it on me. It's like, I'm going to decide, and then I'm going to have an accountability partner where if, you know, I report to every day, and if I don't maintain my diet, then I'm going to have some kind of self-imposed punishment of, all right, I, you know, donate $10 to a charity of his choosing that will irk me or something like that. So rational people can struggle with issues of self-discipline, but they don't benefit from being forced, because being forced into a one-size-fits-all thing and, you know, where the whole nature of it is imposed on them means the complete destruction of their ability to think and self-govern their lives. And if you're talking about the Homer Simpsons of the world who are like, yeah, well, I wouldn't save. I don't know how much and where I would invest it. So it's better that the government just, you know, takes care of me. You can't even talk about that being to their self-interest, because they haven't formed a self that yet has interest. They have not yet put them in a trajectory of pursuing the kind of long-range goals that cohere into a life that's good for them. And so they're not even at the stage of being able to say, is this to or is this for or against their interests? They're basically, they're living their lives in a way where they first need to get to the stage of developing interest. And once you're at that stage, and in order to engage in that process, you need freedom. You need to be able to make your own independent judgments and choices. And that is what force takes off the table. So the last question that I want to go into is, why don't people universally oppose force? And I think it's a legitimate question, because there is a sense, and I think Ankar makes this point, Ankar Gatte makes this point in a talk he gives on the evil of force, which I highly recommend looking up on YouTube, and I'll try to remember to link to in the show notes. He talks about the way in which we all have the direct experience of being under force, and that you experience it as a negative. Like if you're bullied by somebody or somebody steals something from you, it's experienced as a real negative. But why doesn't that lead them to endorse as, a principle that should really guide our lives and guide social organization should be, you know, banning the initiation of physical force? Part of it is something that Leonard Peikoff talks about in Objectivism Through Induction, where the way that you are going to be able to first-handedly induce and grasp the evil of force, the first sort of experience you'd get is this idea of, well, it clashes with my desires. But you can't end there. You have to go further and get, well, my desires come from my conclusions, from my thinking. Because if you just take your desires as a primary, lots of things frustrate your desires. Reality can frustrate your desires. Voluntary, peaceful choices by other people can frustrate your desires. Somebody turns you down for a date, you experience frustration. So force isn't unique if that's your mindset. It's not uniquely bad. It is a real achievement for a person to get, I did all of this thinking in order to reach what's true and what's good. And this guy is saying, no, throw that all away. His emotions are going to rule me. And that's really outrageous and unjust and destructive. That is a real achievement. Or it's similar, a similar kind of thing applies not to the kind of whim worshiper who just takes their desires as primary, but like the second hander who takes other people's desires as like authorities that they have to bow down to. If your experience of life is taking orders, then there's no real difference in terms of the experience of doing things because you're told to and doing things because you're forced to. And so recognizing the evil of force, it really presupposes that to some significant extent in your life, you're a firsthand thinker. Like it doesn't have to be in every issue, but at least in certain profound, important issues in your life, you have your own independent ideas, your own independent values, and you grasp that force is saying, to hell with that. To hell with what you think. To hell with what you think is right. You just have to obey somebody else. So that's one factor. And then the other is that mystical and sacrificial views of morality both mandate the use of force, that they are not consistent with the idea that the initiation of physical force is evil, at least not the view that it's always evil, that it's evil as a matter of principle. And you can think about it this way. What these views amount to is enshrining obedience to authorities. So any form of mysticism, any form of sacrifice is saying, no, you need to obey authorities. That's what's good. And there's absolutely no reason why it's wrong in that context to force the good on people. You can force them to obey authorities, whereas you can't force them to think. And nothing good from that, from the perspective of mysticism and sacrifice, is achieved through disobedience. Disobedience just means you're not doing what's good. Now, you could have this objection, and this is a really popular kind of objection that says, well, how is something good if a person didn't choose it? How is like sacrificing or giving to charity good? How does a person get moral credit if they're forced to sacrifice? But this is treating sacrifice as an issue of charity or benevolence or generosity, and it's saying, well, you don't get moral credit if you're compelled to do it. But the whole perspective of sacrifice is, no, this is not benevolence. This is not generosity. This is a debt that you owe. This is a duty. And so on what grounds are you going to say, hey, don't force me to do my duty? If your grounds are, well, I won't get moral credit if I'm forced. Sacrifice is not about your moral credit. That's selfish. It's like you have no moral standing. You aren't important. You shouldn't be concerned with you. And we, as the people who are going to, you know, dictate your actions, we shouldn't be either. Our only concern is, do you sacrifice? Do you do your duty? And if you won't do it by choice, then morality says we need to make you. So that's it for this section. And that's it finally for chapter 8, the longest chapter in the book. We will start on our discussion next time of happiness, which should be a really fun chapter to go through. In the meantime, be sure to like this video, and to the best way to stay in touch is to go to donswriting.com and sign up for the newsletter. Talk then.